even taking the most generous perspective, that is to say, generous with respect to lockdown efficacy and kind of stingy with respect to collateral damage, the public health consequences of lockdown would exceed the benefits by at least a factor of 30.
Since the start of the COVID-19 crisis, the public health industry, the media, and governments around the world have weaponized science to instill fear in the public. Mask mandates, social distancing guidelines, and lockdowns serve as a constant reminder that we ought to live in fear. The result leads to polarization among the public and, in some cases, mass psychosis. But what is driving this propaganda campaign? Could it be that the COVID-19 crisis is evidence that we have been in the midst of a much larger ideological battle? I'm independent journalist Taylor Hudak, and to discuss the ideology driving the official COVID-19 narrative, the widespread fear and propaganda campaign, today I am joined by Panda Chairman Nick Hudson. Nick Hudson has broad international experience in finance and has settled into a career as a private equity investor. Nick is also the co-founder of Panda, or Pandemics Data and Analytics, an organization of multidisciplinary professionals who perceived the global reaction to COVID and lockdown in particular as overwrought and damaging to the point of causing a great tear in the fabric of society. Panda was established in April 2020 and is a politically and economically independent organization. Panda seeks to develop science-based explanations and test them against international data. In addition to serving as chairman of Panda, Nick has also delivered several speeches and presentations on the COVID-19 crisis. Nick Hudson, first of all, I want to thank you for joining me today. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Real pleasure, Taylor. Lovely to be with you.
So first off, I do want to start broadly here. Can you tell us about Panda, the work that you are involved with, as well as why you decided to create the organization?
Sure. Panda had a very informal beginning. I'm a private equity investor, and I had my annual conference coming up and felt that I would probably get a couple of questions regarding COVID. So I better study up and find out what was going on. And this was in February of 2020. And as I got looking at the data, it struck me immediately that we were dealing with a big disparity between the way the media was portraying things and the emergent reality. And this was immediately concerning for me. I actually had a very uncomfortable feeling about it. As that investor conference went past and we went into March and the whole process started evolving, I began talking to people. I had friends who were an economist, a lawyer, and an immunologist, and who I'd spoken to on a regular basis. And we all came to much the same conclusion. And we became more and more concerned as lockdowns started emerging as a policy response and emerged in something of a flood. We were very concerned that developing countries might be foolish enough to attempt to follow them. It doesn't make sense at all to try and lock down in countries that don't have welfare and social safety nets. And surely enough, there they came, and we went into the famous initial, in our case, 3-week lockdown to flatten the curve, which then was extended and extended and extended. And during our lockdown, we decided to swing into action, and we had noticed that no countries were conducting cost-benefit analysis on any of the measures that were being introduced. And so we put together a paper. By then, our numbers had swelled. And we put together a paper called Quantifying the Years of Life Lost to Lockdown, which was a proposal to adopt insurance mathematics techniques to try and assess the impact of the economic devastation of lockdown on public health and lives, you know, mediated by the economy. There is a very close and very established relationship between the fortunes of the economy and public health. And that article came to the conclusion that even taking the most generous perspective, that is to say generous with respect to lockdown efficacy and kind of stingy with respect to collateral damage, the public health consequences of lockdown would exceed the benefits by at least a factor of 30. That was at a time when we believed there were actually benefits from lockdown. We were happy to assume that there would be, and we took kind of a generous approach to that, as I said. But as the epidemic evolved and we began looking at the data from all around the world, we came to the very surprising conclusion, for us anyway, that lockdowns were actually not helpful. Over time, that conclusion evolved into lockdowns actually being pro-contagion. They were not reducing the number of deaths that a country experienced. And we later found out that there are very good epidemiological reasons for that. In fact, if you've spent even a modest amount of time in the subject, that should be your expectation, that locking down the healthy population in the context of a massively age-graduated epidemic would shift disease burden onto the vulnerable people and thereby worsen mortality. As this all went by, Panda grew and grew. We found that as we spoke out, we attracted many people who had shared similar concerns, people from all disciplines of science, not just immunology and virology and epidemiology, but broader fields like ecology and the physical sciences. And Panda grew into quite a substantial organization. By about October last year, we realized that we were not making any headway against our government, and we diagnosed that as being caused by the fact that everything our government did was being done under the air cover of the World Health Organization, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Gavi, and other international organizations who were putting enormous pressure on our institutions of public health, which had across the board been infiltrated by these organizations. There isn't a single institute of public health or medical faculty in South Africa that has not received copious funding from these organizations. And that extends into, you know, from direct funding to grant funding of the public health scientists who are supposedly representing the interests of the public, but are in fact carrying water for big pharma and vaccine stakeholders. And so we decided to go international. We initially attempted to look for organizations similar to ours overseas, couldn't find any, so we decided instead to take Panda international. And Panda is now represented in more than 30 countries. We have hundreds of scientists, some very preeminent ones. A handful of them are listed on our website, but the majority prefer to remain cryptic members of Panda because of the cancel culture that pertains in the world today. So here we find ourselves with a growing following and continuing to speak out against the pseudoscience that has been prevailing and ruling the public health world, as we see the continuation of measures that simply don't work and the promotion of practices relating to lockdowns, mask wearing, vaccination on a mass basis that just simply does not stack up with the underlying science.
Can you tell us a little bit more about when you began to realize that perhaps we were not being told the truth when it came to COVID-19?
Well, I felt that from the get-go, as I said, there was this massive gap between what the media was saying and what we saw in the data. And what really scared me was that the public health institutions, so in South Africa, it's our National Institute of Communicable Diseases, was pumping out these models that bore no relationship to what we were seeing for us, the best data was from the Diamond Princess cruise ship analysis. There were two papers published in February. They made it very clear that this was a disease that affected the elderly and severely comorbid people. That became clear very early on as well. And that the majority of people in any given population had some form of pre-existing immunity. And the messaging was the exact opposite of that. People were shutting down schools and wetting their beds and losing their minds over this airborne Ebola. World Health Organization aided and abetted this by completely misrepresenting the fatality rates of the disease, trying to pass off the case fatality rate, the rate at which, broadly speaking, people who present at hospital die from the disease, as an infection fatality rate. And over time, that initial 3.4% that they spoke about in a very misleading way has turned out to be close to 0.14%, which is to say in broadly in line with a bad influenza season. So the whole thing was misrepresented from the word go. And from the word go, I had that impression that people were overreacting. And that was a view shared by all of us who came to join Panda. Over time, we have picked up some people who maybe took a bit longer to come around to the cold reality of it. But we also noticed early on that things were being propagandized. There was an incredible coordinated fake video avalanche that came initially out of the CCP, with the Chinese falling men and people staggering through the doors of hospital and dropping dead on the arrival kind of thing. And, over time, everybody realizes that that's not what this disease looks like. Ergo, those videos were fake. And they come from the CCP, because anything on Twitter that comes out of China comes from the CCP. It's not a permitted platform inside China. So there was deliberate propaganda from China, very clearly. It's a matter of fact. Nobody can deny it. But the propaganda continued from governments. We saw them trying to promote these very poorly founded ideas like asymptomatic transmission, children being deadly spreaders of the disease, and granny killers. Lurid advertising, which our behavioral scientists, who are members of Panda, have helped us analyze and unpick. And we can see the deliberate attempts to use nudge-type behavioral psychology and very propagandistic measures to drive fear. That became the public health objective, was to launch a bunch of draconian mandates and to have them accepted by the population only because the population was terrorized out of their cognitive capacity.
Right. I was just going to ask you, is it perhaps the case that these measures such as lockdowns and mask mandates actually elevate the fear? And could this possibly be part of a much broader and larger propaganda campaign?
You need to drop the word possibly, because we've already seen from the minutes and leaks that come out of these behavioral science teams that was their intention. They boldly state it. They sit there in their meetings saying, look, we know these cloth masks don't stop viruses, but what we need to increase the threat level. And so this is not open for debate. This is what they intended to do, and this is what they did. And you also see it in the propagandized science. There's the European CDC published a meta-analysis of mask studies, finding that the vast majority of the studies that were supportive of mask usage were of low evidentiary value, and the vast majority had strong signs of bias. And when you actually look at the ones that are cited and bandied about by public health officials, you see immediately how weak these papers are. They tend to presume the droplet and fomite transmission thesis, which is wrong, as has been found to be completely invalid, is inconsistent with what we know about other respiratory viruses. And they tend to do weird things like try and show that some portion of the larger droplets are stopped by the mask, but then they don't go on to answer the question, what happens next when you breathe out? Do you aerosolize those droplets and send them off into the space around you? So it's just a really represents a low point in science. For me, it's the epitome of derangement, because you've got all these scientists adamant that the cloth masks work and are protective, but there's absolutely no science of it and no sign of it in the epidemiological curves. When you compare one county versus the next, one county that has a mandate, one county that doesn't, when you look at the events of inception of mask mandates and lifting of mask mandates, there's no impact. When you do cross-sectional analysis, there's no impact. And there's no causal mechanism, as I've already described, for preventing the spread of an aerosol airborne virus using cloth masks. It's like throwing sand at a chain link fence. It's just a ridiculous idea. Yet every public health official that you meet will swear by them and tell you that not only should you wear a mask, but you should wear two.
I've interviewed several medical professionals who have spoken about the science. Many of them disagree with the official narrative. So I have to ask you, what allows for this false COVID narrative to be pushed onto the public so successfully?
Well, when you propagandize a narrative of fear, it's very effective. All tyrannical movements or dictatorial movements, centralist movements through the ages have used that as their primary means of gaining control over a population. So there's absolutely nothing new about this. We, as I said, we have evidence for this being what was done, this being the strategy. And it takes hold in people's minds, and you end up with a mass psychosis. This is what we have with COVID. It's a mass psychosis. And that mass psychosis affects people who are not primary actors in the misinformation campaign waged by mainstream media and public health on the populations. They might be doctors or lower level officials in public health who themselves are affected by those campaigns. And that reinforces the dogma, reinforces the terror, and you get ordinary doctors and public health people getting on board with that narrative. It's a very powerful thing and very dangerous.
Well, what about the media in particular?
Media exhibits similar control phenomena. What the broad picture there is that over recent decades, with the emergence of online media and social media, our conventional legacy media outlets have been gradually hollowed out. There's not very much left, you know, for many years prior to COVID, by way of quality investigative and balanced unbiased journalism. Objectivity in journalism left the room a long time ago. So you have very weakened publications with much reduced budgets, employing lower quality people. And then when you add into the mix the possibility of acquiring those outlets at very low prices, it's easy to centralize ownership and control in the hands of a few people who are supportive of the narrative for their own selfish or ideological reasons. So the same people whose political agenda involves lockdown also own media and the fact checkers and the social media censors. And so you get this emergence of a unison voice in global mainstream media, which is amplified by attempts to censor dissent and to echo box the dissenting voices, so that the broader public only get to hear one side of the story.
Many people listening right now may be hearing this and may be wondering why. That's oftentimes the question that people have when they hear about the science and when they hear so many medical professionals just disagree with how this crisis has been handled, as well as the science behind the COVID-19 vaccines. So I do have to ask you, why would anyone do this and purposefully mislead the public? And is centralization the particular ideology that is driving this?
Yeah, I think very much so it is. So let's start with that. We have very much a political agenda advancing centralization. And now, how does political agenda come to pass? Political agenda stimulates a propaganda campaign. And we've spoken about how that is bountifully in evidence. And the propaganda campaign drives towards the distillation of ideology that reinforces the agenda. Very often, political agendas are articulated in terms of expected or inevitable outcomes. This was a reality, I believe, first understood by Marx, who cast the whole evolution of communist society as an inevitable endpoint of the arc of history. So he understood that very well. And I think would-be dictators and tyrants have understood that since then. So what we see is the manifestation of this kind of inevitable outcome in the form of all of these really crackpot theories like the Great Reset, the New Normal, Build Back Better, the Fourth Industrial Revolution, the New World Order, you know, tons of them. And they're always cast not as agenda items, but as inevitable outcomes. But what they're actually doing is telling you what the agenda is. That is the world that they want to see. And the question then can be answered, why? throughout history, and as a, I think, a normal consequence of human nature, powerful elites have always sought to obtain more power. They routinely fall into this trap of believing that they can improve the world if only they had more authority, more power, more control. And it's a pretty widespread phenomenon. When you let go of important institutions of democratic regulation of power, you open the door to those people actually accruing more power. And that is precisely what has happened during the COVID-19 crisis. What we see all around the world is a massive concentration of wealth, massive rising inequality in a very short period of time, with the fortunes of technocratic billionaires ramping up very rapidly as the incomes and livelihoods of middle class and low middle class people and poor people are completely decimated. And it's the sharpest rise in global inequality that we have ever seen in recorded history. People say to me, oh, is this some kind of conspiracy? No, it's not a conspiracy theory. Don't be daft. This is what powerful people do. There's nothing new under the sun. And they don't have to be massively coordinated. They have to just be kind of broadly aligned with the direction of travel. Now, to be clear, there are elements of planning in all of this. They're there to be seen, but it's not really being done in secret. All these kind of events that were techniques of population control that were completely at odds with what appeared in any number of pandemic respiratory virus guidelines were organized, and people were invited to them from intelligence agencies and from public health institutions, from other countries, from China. People were invited to these events, and at these events, they sat there planning, a trajectory that was at odds with what basic public health and pandemic respiratory virus guidelines recommended. I mean, just to tell you how far this goes, it's very hard actually even to find a pandemic guideline that talks about mandating of the quarantining of sick people, let alone the quarantining of healthy people. You never see in pandemic guidelines suggestions that the media needs to be controlled and that dissenting voices need to be suppressed and that censorship needs to be ramped up. But this was a feature of all of these planning events. So there is planning going on, but it's going on in the open. People just didn't notice it. And a hollowed out media with zero intelligence being applied to an analysis of the situation simply jumped on the bandwagon. It was more convenient from them because they were getting funding from some of these organizations and they desperately needed it because they had been hollowed out. And so, it strikes maybe the man in the street who hasn't been paying attention to these things as sounding a bit conspiracy-like, but it's not, because it's all out there. It's in the open. They're telling you what they're doing and why they're doing it, and that's why you can sit in front of your computer and just Google and find it. You don't have to look too hard to find out what world is envisaged by the WEF, and that world that they envisage is their political agenda.
Exactly. This is all unfolding very publicly, and it's in our faces, so to speak.
Yeah. There's this question of is it a cock up, a conspiracy, or an emergent reality? And I say to people, yes, it is. It's all three of those things. They're features of our society that lend themselves to this being a kind of emergent process, one that's not designed by anybody, but a consequence of various features of culture and mood or attitude. There are definitely elements of cock-up, if I may use the term, and there are elements of conspiracy, all three.
How does this ideology of centralism really rely on deliberate polarization in order to achieve its goals?
You need polarization to prevent a coherent opposition from forming. That's the first thing. If you can set up the masses as being opposed to each other instead of opposed to the elite, then you've divided and conquered, and you keep the heat off yourself, the oldest trick in the book. I mean, the disturbing thing about all of this is that, you know, an aversion to centralism is not based in some kind of preference. Centralism has failed wherever it's been attempted. And the same pitfalls are always present. These guys are not doing this because they're evil or think that they're going to do something that's going to hurt the world. You know, they honestly believe their own BS. And the trap is rooted in a well-understood problem called the information problem. They say to themselves, look, this time's different because of technology. We're going to be able to put sensors all over the place, the Internet of Things, the Internet of People. And those sensors are going to upload information that was not available to Stalin and Lysenko in the Soviet revolution. And therefore, we're going to be able to do a better job than those people did. We're going to be able to manage at a much more microscopic level. But where that intellectual thesis completely collapses, is it's actually not even that difficult, is that decisions at a central on a central basis do not fail for want of information. They fail for want of explanations for how the world works. And the world and society and human beings are very complex phenomena and not easily described by explanations. We simply do not know. Cultures and societies evolve in a generative, knowledge-acquiring way when they're decentralized. As soon as you centralize them, you shut down that evolutionary growth process. You corrupt processes of error correction. It's well said by the philosopher David Deutsch that the ultimate evil is destruction of the mechanisms of error correction. But that is precisely what you get when you adopt a follow the science, monolithic kind of approach to any aspect of human organization and human society. So it's not an intellectually difficult step to take to realize that centralization is wrong, not from some kind of simply from some kind of moral perspective, although I believe it is wrong in that regard too. It's wrong in a fundamental way, you know, in a way that, you know, stones floating up off the ground would be wrong because it contradicts the fundamental laws of gravity. So, you know, that's where we are. We have a bunch of elites enamored of power, as elites have always been, who have stumbled across a wonderful way to drive fear into the hearts of people, to divide the populace, and under cover of all of that, to implement a wide-sweeping vision for our future that we have not consented to.
Right. Nobody has agreed to this Great Reset agenda and nobody has voted for this. But I do also want to touch on some more about the centralism ideology in particular, which seems to be quite anti-human. And I've interviewed Professor Richard Werner about this as well, and he said that it is very anti-human. And in fact, it's humans who have allowed us to really initiate positive change in the world. So do you share that same belief? And is there some sort of ideological battle going on here?
Yes, and you see that very much in the polarized groupings. The way we've treated children and elderly people in this epidemic has been very inhumane. Masking the kids, taking them out of school, telling them that they're going to kill granny. I mean, this is horrible, ethically, you know, debased, immoral, degenerate behavior. And yeah, as I said, I don't think people who are behind those kind of actions see themselves as doing anything immoral or unethical. But those of us who are steeped in a more traditional sense of morality see it very quickly that this is degenerate stuff. And so too with the elderly, isolating them, cutting them off from their families, sending sick people into old age homes, forcing treatments upon them, sticking them onto ventilators quickly before it's been established that is the medically correct thing to do. These are just it's evil in a clinical way, which is all the more upsetting. So yes, there's an anti-human kind of construct there, but there's another important way in which this emerges. Centralists are often fellow travelers with Malthusians, people who take an approach to the world of saying that we have only finite resources and we're going to run out of something, topsoil, coolness, you know, when it comes to climate change, or, yeah, fresh water or anything, you know, of that nature, food. That's the Malthusian construct, is that there is some kind of finite resource that humans are depleting. But what that ignores completely is the creation of future knowledge. We are, as a species, completely capable to generate future knowledge and do more with less. And we do that year after year, provided that centralists don't get their way. So the centralist ideology contains this very anti-human Malthusian perspective, which is self-fulfilling if they get their way.
All right, Nick, so we did touch on this deliberate polarization, but can you speak about this in the context of COVID-19? I mean, there are some people out there who are wearing masks who are very fearful of this virus, COVID-19, while there are others who are questioning the narrative. How is it that we could be so polarized with our beliefs and ideas and attitudes toward this virus and how our governments have handled it?
Yeah, I think one of the key levers in all of that was the notion of asymptomatic transmission. When you look at where this idea came from, it's quite horrifying. There were two very seminal papers that sit at the root of all of the emergent literature on this subject, and both of them had serious problems. The first one was a very simple little observational study that involved one Chinese woman who purportedly infected six of her colleagues in Germany while asymptomatic. But it turned out that she was receiving treatment for flu symptoms. So she wasn't asymptomatic at all. So bang goes one of the two papers. And the other one was a paper that's quite patently fraudulent that emanated from the CCP. So both of the two seminal papers that launched this whole mythology of asymptomatic transmission being a driver of the epidemic were without any basis in reality. And the rest of the papers really cascaded from there, because people began building models. And models just are hugely dangerous things when you use them to try and describe complex phenomena. But these models would take calibrations from the other two papers for little parameters like the probability of transmission from an asymptomatic individual, and then making a lot of other assumptions, often tacit, such as that such asymptomatic transmission is as likely to lead to disease as symptomatic transmission. They would then lead through a very convoluted modeling calculation to the conclusion that, for example, half of all disease stems from asymptomatic transmission. But because the underlying axioms were wrong and the tacit assumptions were wrong, these papers are also really to be disregarded. They're unscientific and should never have been published. The way I land on this, it's very difficult to reach firm conclusions because there has been so little robust study of the phenomenon. But my sense is that asymptomatic transmission is more likely to involve transmission of immunity than it is to involve transmission of disease. The dose size, the inoculum of transmission, is important. And if you have somebody who has robust immunity and they're infected, their body very quickly deals with the virus. The virus does replicate in their systems, but that replication is kept under control. And when they're shed very low titers of virus. And I would suspect that a person getting infected by such an asymptomatic person is in turn likely to receive a very small inoculum of virus that, unless they're in particularly bad health, their systems are able to deal with. And so it's a way of kind of spreading a natural vaccine. Now, the fact that there isn't data available to refute such a conjecture is telling you everything you need to know about the state of the science here. And I go back to Anthony Fauci's pronouncements in the first quarter of last year that asymptomatic transmission has never been the driver of any epidemic of a respiratory virus. I believe that that remains true and that no evidence to the contrary has ever been presented.
I do my best to keep my own personal opinions and attitudes outside of these interviews. But one thing that I am curious to hear your perspective on is how people who would otherwise be questioning the mainstream narratives, who tend to be quite critical of governments and of the media, have fallen for this COVID-19 narrative. Why is that?
Fear, in a word. That's the central operating lever in a mass psychosis. People were very afraid at the beginning, and once that fear was there, you can tell them to do anything. So I look very, it's very interesting for me to try and diagnose the psychological commonality of the members of Panda. It's almost impossible. Yes, there are those people who are kind of stoical in character, or, you know, to put it nicely, or to put it harshly, somewhat kind of on the spectrum. And less moved by everybody else's excitement than the average person. So there are people like that, but there are some, you know, people where I can't really detect any of that. They, for whatever reason, adopted a more skeptical approach, or just held on to their minds. And that could, the characteristic in operation there could be simple, plain old courage, that they were not people who were easily scared for whatever reason of their development and psychological nature. So I think what happened was there was a minority of people who called BS on the whole escapade from the start and watched everybody else going crazy. That, by the way, can be a really reinforcing thing when you see somebody in your ambit go from a sound, sensible human being to a bedwetting maniac in the space of a couple of days. That then reinforces the idea in your own mind that something's going badly wrong and is kind of like an inoculation against the mania. And I think at that point, you split off, you peel off a group of people who are never going to be shaken, never going to be terrified. And they form the nexus of the dissenting minority, which over time will grow into a majority. That's going to happen. But that process is incredibly slow. The saying of Charles McKee is really pertinent for me. He says that men go mad in herds and recover their senses one by one. And that process of people recovering their senses is slow. And the role that people who never lost their senses play, I think, is very important.
We have become a more secular society over the past 50 years, I would say. And we've also seen at the same time many people worship individuals such as Dr. Fauci. Is there any correlation there?
Yes, absolutely. I subscribe to the idea that there's no man is truly free of religion. There's a psychological impetus towards some kind of sense of the numinous or some kind of higher power. And when people delete God concept from their lives, they replace it with something else. And in this case, I think many people replaced, you know, when that God-shaped hole left by the secularization of society, when it comes to times of fear and emergency, is filled by characters such as Fauci. And that's a very bad story, because regardless of your metaphysical predispositions, religion comes with a highly embroidered and subtle framework of morality and tradition that addresses many issues that to an extent are things that surpass human understanding. They contain something of the ineffable. They solve problems that are a little bit immune to analytical reasoning. And kind of survive to the extent that they do. Whereas the sudden rapid onset of a cultish belief in one particular scientist is not likely to contain any of those rich solutions. So you get yourself into trouble very quickly when you make of Fauci a god. Many people refer to that as scientism, and I think it is a correct description. If you just think about the structure of the follow the science problem, it's that, you know, follow the science is the very opposite of the scientific process. And I say the scientific process because science is not an institution. Science is a way of challenging authoritarian dogma. It's a way of critiquing a thesis or a conjecture or an explanation. And in so doing, pulling down the establishment view so that it may be replaced by improved explanations for how the world works. So follow the science is actually follow the narrative. It has nothing to do with science, and the narrative is the narrative of a new cult.
It seems as if science is becoming a religion in this era.
Yes, and I really battle with even saying a sentence like that, because to people like me, science remains science and something very admirable and something we should all admire and seek to fuse our mental lives with. But the thing that's being pursued here, I wouldn't even like to call it a religion, because I have respect for religion. And so it's what's happening here is people are pursuing the dogmas of a crazed cult and trying to label it science. And their pursuit of that crazed cult shares some characteristics of the faithful in traditional religion.
Well, I think it is fair to say that science is being used to push fear and coercion, which I don't think is ever acceptable in public health, but we're seeing that, especially recently, with this new push for vaccine passports.
Yes, I think it is morally indefensible to deliberately scare people. The vaccine passports have nothing to do with public health. They're ridiculous ideas. You know, maybe it's worth talking about that for a minute or two, because there's some interesting observations that I would make. The idea with the vaccine passport is that you signify certain individuals as being less likely to transmit a particular risk to somebody. Now, we could feasibly do that across a whole range of dimensions. We could say that, oh, poor people have worse diets, therefore they're more likely to transmit disease. We could say that fat people have worse immune systems, they're more likely to transmit disease. We could say that old people have worse immune systems, so that, and we could refuse to give them immune passports, creating a kind of apartheid society on dimensions of obesity, age, or income. And that is essentially the structure that we're dealing with, is we deem certain people who have received a certain injection to have a low likelihood of transmitting and the rest not to have. And that's false, first of all. You know, we have recovered individuals who have broader, more durable, and more robust immunity against the disease than vaccinated people, regardless of whether the recovered people have been vaccinated or not. So an unvaccinated recovered person presents much less risk than any vaccinated non-recovered person. There's a starter. A young, uninfected, non-recovered person is, when I talk about children here, very likely to suffer symptomatic disease and to become a significant threat. Children are not big spreaders of this illness. They seldom experience severe disease. Households that have more children expose the adults to less risk than households that have fewer children, for example. That gives you some indication of what's at play. So the intellectual foundations of mass vaccination and vaccine passports are, in with respect to this kind of disease, and definitely with respect to these leaky vaccines, are incredibly tenuous, I would say bogus. And I don't find it at all difficult to reach the conclusion that it has nothing to do with public health, that we are, this is all part of the trajectory towards social engineering and control of populations. There's no epidemiological or medical reason to be vaccinating recovered people or young people. There probably is a medical reason to be vaccinating elderly people. But even then, if you confront the question of whether such vaccines should be mandated, so for example, mandatory vaccinations for the non-recovered vulnerable would probably have a medical thesis behind them, but the epidemiological thesis is weak. The number of people you need to vaccinate in order to prevent one theoretical death in some other part of the population of presumably unvaccinated people is very, very high. And so the logic is quite weak. And I always say that you need to go straight to ethical and moral principles. We came out of the Second World War with a keen insight into the risk of allowing medicine to become a securocrat weapon. And we set up principles like the Nuremberg Code, the Syracuse principles, to prevent that ever from happening again. The greater good argument is so shaky that I think it should simply be ignored. It's really not on solid epidemiological or medical grounds. And we need to go back to basic common sense. The reasoning that says, an old person or a fat person has no choice in how they are, whereas an unvaccinated person has a choice. That's not a good route to go down. You find yourself in very treacherous waters very quickly.
I would now like to talk about the censoring of this information. Has Panda experienced any censorship on social media or the other streaming platforms?
A great many of the members of Panda and of similar organizations have suffered immense censorship. And it comes in some, stealthy forms, some overt forms, and in some quite aggressive forms. In the last week in the country where I live, South Africa, I have experienced myself a series of smear campaigns in the mainstream media. They're all without any basis of fact. We wrote a response article. The right of response was declined by all of the publications. We managed to get it into one of the few remaining unbiased media outlets in the country, one of the few with the courage to actually present both sides of the story. And in that, we make it clear that all of our perspectives that they critiqued were actually rooted in solid basic science, and we provided all the references to the science. We corrected the false information that included about our perspectives and about our past statements. And, you can do that. But when you're facing these absolutely pathetic excuses for journalists at these mainstream media outlets who are simply, doing the bidding of their funders, it's very difficult. We've seen scientists deplatform from social media platforms simply for reposting peer-reviewed scientific articles without comment, not saying, guys, this is what this article means, just reposting the article that's already been peer-reviewed by whatever, Journal of the American Medical Association or whatever, then that's enough. They will get removed from Twitter. We had a very comical one where on our Facebook account, we posted a slide that showed the World Health Organization's recommendations on masking. Now, we didn't post that slide because we agreed with them. We think cloth masking in the face of a viral epidemic is absurd, non-anti-science, pseudoscience stuff. We posted there just to point out that many countries' rules were contradicting the World Health Organization. That slide was removed from our Facebook account. The slide of the World Health Organization's policy, because it contradicted local community community guidelines in respect of the edicts of local health authorities. So it's really pathetic, shameful stuff. And we need to find ways to decentralize social media and media in order to create a parallel society in a way, in order to push back against this very dark, evil tendency.
Isn't it really insulting to the public, though, to be taking down this information as if members of the public are unable to determine what is and what is not factual information?
Of course, and but it's insulting to the public to project a fear narrative at them, you know, under this idea that you can only get them to do the right thing because they're all such stupid sheep. If you terrorize them into doing it, that you won't be able to reason with them. And of course, you know, that's the sort of actually a very kind interpretation of what's gone on, because the reality is that they knew you wouldn't be able to reason with them because there is no good reason for promoting these draconian policies. It's actually, they're all bad reasons. They're all sinister. So, yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. The disparaging view taken of the average person, the disparaging approach to human agency, to individual rights, to bodily integrity and sanctity of the human being, harkens back to everything we've been talking about in this hour.
Should people be concerned about this new push for sustainability and to maintain climate change, or combat climate change, rather? I know that during the spring of 2020, there was some discussion in the media about how the lockdowns were helping the environment. Should people be alarmed by this? And just recently, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said we should be tackling climate change like we have been tackling COVID-19. Should people be concerned?
People should be very concerned. This concept of sustainability is a fudge word for Malthusianism, which we spoke about earlier. The same idea, you know, that we've got some kind of finite provision and we're using it up too much. It's unsustainable. What we're doing is at the root of all this thinking. And obviously, in certain circumstances, something can be unsustainable. If I've gone on a hiking trip with 3 days worth of food and I eat 3 days worth of food on the first day, that's an unsustainable rate of eating on it in some way. But if I have a technology that allows me to procure new food, then it's not unsustainable. So it's again contingent on the generation of future knowledge, and this is completely ignored by these alarmists. And again, we see the continually emerging pattern in centralist dogma of fabricating or exaggerating a threat and admitting only centralist solutions to the problem. So, you know, I'm not one who would say that what humans do to the earth is always benign. Far from it. I worry a lot about habitat destruction, for example. I'm a very keen wildlife guy. I spend a lot of time out in the savannah and in the woodlands here in Africa. It's my favorite place. And I am terribly saddened by the Chinese loggers who have cut down the rainforests and the Maombo forests of northern Mozambique and Zambia. It's very disturbing for me. And that is habitat destruction on a very significant scale, which I think we should all work hard against. So I'm not some kind of draconian industrialist who thinks that you can obliterate wetlands and forests with no poor consequences. But this idea that there is a massive looming immediate problem that has no solution in future technology, that we should all undertake very costly and destructive responses to, you know, destruction, and the destruction's real. If you go and do a climate lockdown, if you go and impose all sorts of costs on society, what you're doing is the same thing that we were worried about with lockdown. You're casting a public health burden on somebody out there. Somebody else's livelihood is affected. Somebody has less food to eat, less quality in their lives, and there is destruction happening. So I think to a large extent, all of these problems, there's a long list of them that the centralists fabricate and exaggerate, are of a type, and we need to be alive to them. When you hear these buzzwords like sustainability and inclusivity, your ears need to prick up and you need to take a very suspicious attitude to the words that follow and the admonitions that follow.
Nick, is there anything that you would like to leave us off with today?
I like to end everything off with talking about what I think is going to be the most important commodity in the world, which is courage. We need people who are calm and courageous to accelerate the process of the restoration of sanity, of retrieving people one by one from the mass psychosis. An alarming tendency that I see rising up on our side is this talk of retribution and Nuremberg trials and people who will be hanging from the gallows when the true criminality of what has been done is exposed and we reassert power as a democracy or as a people. I would not like to see things go in that direction, and I think it undermines the moral power and the moral persuasiveness of our side of the debate to indulge in that talking. We need calm and courage and humanity to be in our corner, because it is certainly not in the corner of the technocrats, of the Bill Gateses of the world. These people are inhumane. These people are dangers to all of us. And we need to model the behavior that is the opposite of them.
This has been an excellent and enlightening discussion. Nick Hudson, thank you.
Thank you very much, Taylor. Always a real pleasure talking to you, and all the best with your continued efforts.
Thank you. And I want to thank you all for watching this interview. Please don't forget to share it on your social media. And if you would like to stay up to date with Nick's work, you can follow him on Twitter at NickHudsonCT, and you could visit his website, pandata.org. Once again, I want to thank all of you for watching this video and supporting The Last American Vagabond. Please don't forget to subscribe to our channel, and don't forget to also like this video. Once again, I want to thank you all for watching. I'm independent journalist Taylor Hudak, and I'll see you in the next video.